Hello, I am your noble, robotic, introducer, and this is the Class War Battlefield Podcast. Welcome to episode 2021.00.01. This podcast is being published on Wednesday, January 13, 2021. If you would like a copy of today's episode, download it for free at radio4.net. That's radio4.net. You can also download episodes from iTunes, Google Podcast, and anchor.fm. You can reach out to your host if you have any questions at radio4.net and anchor.fm. Today's episode title is How Did We Get Here? The Broken Society and the War Between the Republican Characters. Now, on with the episode.
And now,
the definition.
Recorded on December 31st, 2020.
Hi, my name is Frank Schaefer, and I don't think very many people who watch this video are going to like it. I don't like it myself, because when you tell the truth about the situation we face, it's sometimes not popular. Let me start by saying that I come from the religious right. My family were leaders in the formation of the religious right in the 70s and 80s. If you have hated the years in which Donald Trump is president, if you lament and mourn as I do the slide of the evangelical subculture into a Trump personality cult, then blame me and my father, my family, and the people we worked with, like Dr. C. Everett Koop, who became Surgeon General, President Ronald Reagan, the Bush presidents, all of whom we knew, Gerald Ford and others, who began to use evangelical Christians as a kind of a cannon fodder to build their conservative movement, and then their far-right nationalist white movement. We are where we are today because my family and others like me played a part in selling our country down the river for access to power. I repented of this more than 35 years ago, and I fled the religious right and have made my living as a writer, a novelist, commentator, outside of the God business. That's my background. What I'd like to say now, though, as we head into the new year, is something that you are not going to want to hear. We all talk about getting 2020 behind us and moving into 2021 as if somehow COVID, the virus, our political leaders, events outside of our control follow a calendar where we can kind of sign off one year and start a new one. This is an illusion. Let me remind you of something. History does not follow timetables. When World War I started and then World War II started, one thing was the same in both. Everyone on both sides of the war said it'll be over by Christmas in a few months. It wasn't. We have a vaccine rollout, an amazing, miraculous vaccine that was invented in 1 year by brilliant people from Turkey, from Germany, from the UK, from the United States and others, who work tirelessly on yours and my behalf, that is now being wasted because Donald Trump fumbled the rollout the way he's fumbled everything else. We don't have a national healthcare system. Everything's being left to local officials and the states with no help from the federal government and no funding. 2021 is not going to shape up to be any easier or better than 2020 was. If anything, it's going to be worse, because we have an enclave of religious voters who were refusing to accept the presidency of Joe Biden. You know, I want to remind you of something, and that is that when the Civil War was about to break out, even the secessionist leaders of the South about to commit treason against the United States did not question the election of Abraham Lincoln. For them, that was beyond the pale. Not for Republicans today, who question the election of Joe Biden, a clear victory that every judge, every Republican who is in charge of an election as an official in a locality says was legitimate. So we're in a new place. We are going forward with a sizable portion of the American population no longer committed to democracy, who are feeling terrible because their attempted coup on behalf of Donald Trump did not succeed. We are going forward carrying the baggage of Donald Trump. That means we have a failed vaccine rollout, which is going to take far longer than we thought. In addition to which, because health issues have now been politicized, even wearing a mask has been politicized, there is no guarantee that enough Americans will get the vaccine, no matter how the rollout is conducted. Not just the anti-vaxxer lunatics, but other people who somehow, as a protest, are still saying this isn't real. And so we face a future in some ways less uncertain than we did as a country going into the Civil War, when democracy was acknowledged to have worked and the disagreement was over slavery, over the South, states' rights, and other things, not over the basic constitutional issues of how elections work. Say it again. On the eve of World War I and World War II, everybody said, oh, it'll be over by Christmas. These wars lasted 4-5 years. 4 and 5 years. The aftermath of COVID is not going away because the calendar ticks over from 2020 to 2021. If we are lucky, by 2022, the vaccine rollout will have started to do some good in terms of herd immunity. If we are lucky, by the end of Joe Biden's presidency, he will have gotten us back to where we were on the first day of Donald Trump's presidency in terms of restoring some respect and some sanity and some international standing and some viability in this country, and no longer coddling billionaires at the expense of everyone else. If we are very fortunate, we will have the acumen to look at those terrible and frightening photographs of our empty cities with foxes and coyotes and other things wandering around our downtown areas, and be reminded that if we do not address the cataclysm that really awaits us, which is not COVID, to which it is a Sunday school picnic by comparison, I'm talking about climate change and global warming, we will make COVID look like a dress rehearsal for something far greater. So don't delude yourself. As the clock ticks over to 2021, as we head out into this new year with a new president, we have a party that refuses to acknowledge him, a group of people who will not be governed, who have turned this country into an ungovernable mess, where we can't even get people to wear masks, let alone comply with some sort of vaccine regime, where our federal government is non-existent and doesn't help anybody with this vaccination program, but it's left to the likes of CVS and Walgreens and Walmart and your local walk-in urgent care center to administer what in other countries, like for instance Israel or Germany or South Korea or Taiwan, is being administered on a federal level on a wartime footing that puts everything aside, civil liberties and all the rest of it, and charges ahead and gets this done. Our idea of freedom in America today, going into 2021, is personal license and selfishness. I have a right to carry a gun with a 100-round magazine. To hell with the mass murders. I don't care about that. I have a right to this gun. I have a right not to wear a mask. I have a right to say that the election was phony because it suits me and my conspiracy theories, irrespective of what the truth is. Well, the party is over. 2021 is shaping up as worse than 2020. The world war we are in against COVID and the world war that is coming right on its heels against climate change has yet to begin.
Recorded on January 7th, 2021.
Hi, this is Frank Schaefer. I used to be an evangelical right-wing extremist. I quit the evangelical movement and fled. And for the last 35, almost 40 years, I have been a liberal activist that mostly votes for Democratic candidates. My father, Francis Schaeffer, called for violent overthrow of the U.S. government in his last book, A Christian Manifesto, where he said that if Roe v. Wade wasn't reversed and abortion made illegal by democratic means, then we had a right to revolution. Well, last night when the Capitol was attacked, the evangelicals who were in the forefront of that attack were the kind of people who were influenced by him or influenced by people who were influenced by him. My family was responsible, and I was responsible as the nepotistic sidekick of Francis Schaeffer, along with C. Everett Koop, Ronald Reagan, Surgeon General, people like Jack Kemp, the congressman and candidate for the vice presidency who introduced me to the president, the folks that helped me like Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell establishing the moral majority for what happened last night. Without evangelical participation, Trump would not be president. If you want to personally thank someone who made Trump president, talk to Franklin Graham of the Billy Graham Organization. Talk to Ralph Reed, the political operative who cashes in again and again and fundraises and makes millions off his evangelical activism. America does not have a political problem. We have a religious fanaticism problem without which none of this would have happened. If it wasn't for evangelical churches, organizations, pastors, newsletters, radio hosts going along with Trump's lies, supporting them, supporting him when he was elected, supporting him through his villainous presidency and even to today, we would not be where we are. We have squeaked by the skin of our teeth of having a democracy this morning at all. We are only barely hanging on with our fingernails at this point. But the media does not get it. They have never taken the evangelical movement seriously. They talk about the Rust Belt. They talk about Appalachia. They talk about the low pay of working class America. All true, but they ignore because they are afraid to delve into and get into the truth of what white evangelicalism has become, which is a white nationalist racist movement, xenophobic, myth-based. The theology is a myth. The stuff evangelicals believed in did not happen. The stuff they do not believe in, science, global warming, democracy, did happen. We are now a mockery of China and Russia. We are now a mockery of dictatorships all over the world who looked at that invasion as proof that America is failing. Vladimir Putin won. We lost, put it that way. Now today, Trump still is in office for a few more days, and he is going to continue to do incalculable damage to America. But none of this, I repeat, is possible without understanding that we have been in a war of religion where fundamentalist evangelical white Christians and their conservative Roman Catholic allies have pitted themselves against our democracy because what they really want is a theocracy. What they aim for is America to become an evangelical Christian bigoted version of Iran. I come from that background. I knew the key players in the 70s and 80s that started all this. Trump would not be where he is today without 40 years of evangelical, hate-filled, anti-American propaganda that has debased debate on race, on gender, on feminism, has gone after women and gay people, transgenders, black people. Enough is enough. And I call on the US media and anyone who sees this video to spread this word. The party of theocracy is at the root of our problems. That's why they cling to their guns. That's why they arm themselves, because they want this country ruled not by democracy, but by theocrats that impose an evangelical fundamentalist slash Roman Catholic vision of morality on America, on other citizens who do not buy into it. And that's why they tried to engineer and stack the courts. And that's why they listened when Trump rejected the election results and lied and said the election was stolen. Fundamentally, these people are not interested in democracy. They are theocrats. Get it through your head. From someone who was there and help make this tragedy happen. Even though I was a young, stupid, greedy man who changed his mind, nevertheless, I was there. It's not about politics. It's about theocracy versus democracy. Evangelicals are now the nexus of opposition to American democracy and patriotism. My name is Frank Schaefer.
Is rising against the privileged minority of the earth.
This is why I say it's liberty or it's death. It's freedom for everybody or freedom for nobody.
This is an NBC News Hotline special report.
We're at a turning point in the history of this nation. We need to stand for freedom. There's an escalating authoritarianism and even a creeping fascism. Freedom is precious. If we don't fight for it, you lose it.
This much is clear.
We must rebel.
This is our country. We have always lived in it. We were happy. Then you came. We have to protect ourselves. We have to save our country. We have to fight for what is ours.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is your brother, Brian Mayer Ardis, coming at you with another, with an addendum, should I say, to the emergency podcast episode that I posted. You just heard what I think are possibly the two most important clips that you didn't hear about what happened at the Capitol from Frank Schaefer. Now, the first one that you heard was, here's the truth, 2021 is going to be worse than 2020. Now, he recorded that on December 31st, 2020. And then the second one you heard was the Capitol invasion was not about politics, but religion. Both of these you needed to hear. Both of them. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm a compassionate person. I am. And I've been thinking a lot about what happened and what has been happening over the last 10 plus years. I'm a compassionate person. I was ready to come on here and just say, you know, we need to isolate these people and not let them into communities again and blah, blah, blah. And then I re-listened to my Charlotte's Web episode, one of my favorite episodes that I ever recorded. Which is so weird because I was so lost during that period when I did that episode. And I realized, 2017, I had made the argument that Chris Hedges and Cornel West and all them are making. More, and by the way, that argument is that you need to reintegrate these people into the mainstream of life. More, as I started thinking back over the last 25 years, I realized that a lot of the friends that I grew up with, and 25 years ago, I was a teenager, to help you out with that math. And the community that I lived in, the county that I lived in, had a lot of jobs. A lot of jobs. And the community that I lived in, it was a pretty small community, had five major factories, one that was seasonal. I think two were seasonal. Yeah, two were seasonal. But they were really big employers. And the other three, to greater and lesser extents, employed people year-round. Outside of the community, within probably about 20 minutes, there were probably a dozen other factories, maybe more. There was this place called Full Pack. And for those of you who do not know Full Pack, there was a time on the East Coast, if you received pretty much, well, I can't say everywhere on the East Coast, but I was surprised from friends of mine who found their products throughout the East Coast whenever they would travel. But they made a lot of shipping containers, boxes, small boxes for delivery, for food, for things like that. Well, in I think it was 97, 98, they packed up and went to China. No, China or Mexico, one of the two. That crushed the community that was next to mine. A couple of years later, one of the biggest employers in my community, they were founded in the community. They had been there for, I think, 100 years, were purchased by this conglomerate. And even though it was one of the best performing warehouses that they had, I know that because I worked there, especially among those years, we were always number two behind furniture. They had this huge furniture warehouse, which we just couldn't beat because it was furniture. But we were always number two. But they were pissed off because they had to actually pay for the community which they operated in. So at first they moved the warehouse, this was in 2008-2009, to Pennsylvania, and then because of mismanagement at the top, they went bankrupt. In 2009, one of the largest employers in my community shut down. Well, it didn't shut down, but they announced that they would be leaving. Now, the interesting thing about this is I ended up working there for the last gasp of that company. The guy who purchased it was from Texas. That's why when people talk to me about how patriotic people from Texas are, I laugh in their face. This man, now look, this company didn't make tens of millions of dollars. It wasn't built to do that. But this man bought the company and then announced that it would be closing and moving to China in 2011-2012. They even sent people from our company to go to China to teach the people there how to do their jobs. The year that I was there, and I wasn't even there for a year, I was there for like 4 or 5 months when they were closing down. That Christmas, this person who bought this company and was about to lay everybody off came to the company, came up to have lunch with the company employees around Christmas. He was about to lay all these people off, and he came to sit with them like he was one of the average Joes there. I wanted to spit in his face. The bottom fell out after that. Within 3 years, the local grocery store went out of business. It had been there for decades. But how it made its money was within 5 minutes of the three largest employers was the grocery store. I can still remember with amazing fondness, you know, back in 2001 and 2002, us piling in the car on break, on lunch break, 8 o'clock, and racing over to the grocery store to grab something and to get back. There was a company that employed 100 or so people that was literally within 5 minutes walking. I moved shortly after right before actually the grocery store closed, but looking back on it, you know, there has been a couple of companies, by the way, that have moved in, but the town, it has been shattered, absolutely shattered, and that's the thing that I had to realize. It has been shattered, it has been broken. I watched over the years as my friends became broken and shattered. You know what's sad about it? And the more I think about this, the more angry I get. The people who were doing the breaking and shattering of our community and dozens of communities like it, they were putting money into right-wing, corporatist, fascistic commentators and radio stations to encourage people like those living in my community to take out their frustration not on the corporations who deserve their frustration, but on the government. And I've talked to people about this. And they are, because now we are 35 years now since all this really began. And you got to give these guys credit, man. The Powell memo, which was in the beginning of the 70s, these people went to work. And it took them nearly 50 years, but they have accomplished what they wanted to accomplish, which was to crush the left, to stop the liberalization of education, to stop what they thought of as radicalism, which they wonderfully defined as questioning capitalism, which they thought was an extension of the 60s, but truthfully it was an extension of the 40s and the 30s when capitalism failed. It's a natural thing to question systems that are not natural to you. They've planned. They wanted a corporate paradise. They wanted a paradise where corporations can rule supreme. And you know what they've gotten? They've gotten that. They have gotten that. It's so funny. I wonder if Bill Clinton understood what he was signing into existence with the Telecommunication Act. He was killing his own party. Then again, he might have understood that. Because he wanted to displace the Kennedys. He wanted to displace the old guard. It's, you know, there's this book that I found called Roosevelt's Purge. And I would encourage you to get it because it talks about some of the dynamics that occurred within the party, which led to FDR making some very interesting decisions about where the party should be and who should be in it. And I was thinking after, you know, reading about a chapter of that book, the new center in the Democratic Party after the 60s was the Northeast. I mean, it had always been the Northeast, but it really hinged around the Kennedys and a few other families, right? After the late 90s, the center of the party was Bill Clinton and the Clintons from Arkansas, from down south. Coincidence? Oh, no. I don't. But what I will say is this. considering what that book says about who he was fighting, that's FDR, and what became, what the new Democrats pushed, it's not a coincidence. Roosevelt's Purge, ladies and gentlemen, get the book. I don't know if it's going to be possible to reintegrate these people into the into community and into the country. That's a lot of work. It's going to take as a, I don't know, I was listening to somebody and they were saying that they have a 15-year plan on how to do this. And they're right, it's going to take like 15 years to suture this thing. But what I will say is this, because Martin Luther King Day is coming up, and I was thinking about Dr. King and the fights that black civil rights leaders and those who supported them engaged in the mid-60s, a portion that is rarely talked about. And I was thinking about some of the comments that Dr. King himself made about segregation in the North and how almost participatory segregation was for Northern liberals, and how behind Northern liberals, he didn't say this, but you know, you could see this, especially you read the book Uncle Tom's Cabin, Harriet Beecher Stowe gets into it on there, but how behind a lot of Northern liberalism and a lot of Northern liberals was this air of conservatism, which condoned segregation in the North and embraced segregators from the North, and thought almost as lowly of black people as did the Southerners, yet they just didn't want to see black people hurt as much. In the South, and this is often overlooked, in the South, you had what amounts to a theocratic, oligarchic, Republican system. You had a theocratic, oligarchic, Republican system. And in that system was, for black people, codified in strict segregation. But the overall system was not only unfair to black people, this is why, and by the way, not only unfair to black people, but unfair to brown people, unfair to red people, but it was massively unfair to poor white people too. This is why Dr. King, in his group, didn't settle on the rights of black people. This is why they decided that they would save the soul of America by going after the injustices that afflicted not only black people, and typically it affected, those injustices affected black people a lot worse, but it affected all people. Because he understood that if you just pulled black people up and you didn't do anything to alleviate the pain of the poor, rural, white person, it would be all for naught. Plus, black people are just that way. We look out for everybody. It's kind of funny to see that these MAGA people are calling for All Lives Matter when black people literally do believe all lives matter. This is why, you know, the problem, as I've often told my friends, isn't that you yell white power. The problem is what you mean by it and what you intend to do with it. But I digress. The North prided themselves on not having a theocratic oligarchic Republican system. They had kind of a secular Christian oligarchic Republican system. Which I know you'd be like, well, wait a minute, that doesn't make sense. But when you really think about it, it does. And it was from that secularism, not the Christianity, that they drew some more of the humane principles, which they then sculpted democracy from. Now, I'm not going to lie to you here, like a lot of other people will. The country has never been about democracy. But the humane principles which the North was able to implement was supposed to shear off the rough edges, the sharp edges of capitalism, and, this is hardly ever mentioned, the Republican system. So, for far too long, both of these systems existed together in one country. In the South, the theocratic oligarchic Republican system, and in the North, the secular Christian oligarchic Republican system. And finally, after World War II, and after a lot of disgraces, black people said, yeah, we're done playing these games. So we want freedom from this theocratic doctrine, which has kept us enslaved. And so the fight began. The goal was never to end real segregation, to implement real equality. The goal was to take the secular Christian aspects, especially the humane aspects from the secular Christian oligarchic Republican system in the North, and to implement it in the South. You can still have your theocratic concepts, but those are going to now be in the church. Those are going to be in your social systems. But for your political system, you need to have humane principles. You need to implement some humanitarianism. And for a while that worked, for a very brief while. But the oligarchs in the South, who had been supported massively by a network of not always theocratic oligarchs, but definitely oligarchic Republicans who saw the usefulness of their theocratic doctrine to create castes within the society, which is something, by the way, that a Republican system needs. A Republican system needs castes. That's why I keep telling y'all, this ain't a democracy. It's a republic. This isn't a democratic republic, because it doesn't exist. Those two things do not exist together. Democracy is dramatically different than a republic, but I digress. They saw the need for the theocracy, and look, these people weren't stupid. They've always seen the need to use theocratic reasoning to implement a corporatist and a capitalist agenda. You can go all the way back to Father Coughlin, and the whole idea of pulling your boots up by its own straps, that's actually an idea that is very old in this country, and it's foolish because you can't do it. It's impossible. It's impossible. Have you ever tried? Put on boots with straps and then lift yourself up with them. Lay down and lift yourself up with them. It's impossible, ladies and gentlemen. And that's the rouge. You can't do it. It goes back a while. But it goes back to the social gospel fights of the 1870s, 1880s, 1890s. When pastors and ministers and Catholic priests started challenging what they saw, and I think correctly, was the resurrected ideology that had been used during the feudalist times to justify the king's rulership over the serfs. They fought against that. So this isn't new. This is not new. So when black people started pushing against that, the North made the decision to force the theocratic aspect of the culture and of the political system into their churches and their other societies, while putting outwardly the humane principles. Well, in the 1970s, that theocratic instinct rose again and started catching fire. There's a great picture of Dr. King and Billy Graham that I that's in a book that I have here. And it's stunning to see the life in Dr. King and the deadness in Billy Graham. It might actually not be Billy. It might be his father. But either way, it was clear that one was working to save man. The other one was working to enslave man. They were going very separate, you know, two very separate places. But this theocratic idea started rising again. And instead of fighting it, I mean, to be honest with you, the liberals and stuff were in such a disarray. They were getting attacked on so many different sides. People who were standard bearers in the late 60s were dead, jailed, exiled, which tells you something about who the CIA, the DIA, the FBI really, really wanted in this country, in control of things. But I digress. So I understand their problems. I also understand from Rick Perlstein's brilliant book, Matt Stoller's book, and I'm missing one. Democracy in Chains. No, not that one. I can't think of the other one that I'm missing. Anyway, but I also understand that there was a little bit of arrogance. And there was also an inability to comprehend the consequences of inflation and the pricing problems of the 1970s. Liberals did not understand that this was having a dramatic impact on people. They also didn't seem to get that there were a lot of issues that were being weaponized against them in a fashion that kind of, I don't really understand how I want to say this. I'm sorry, y'all. But there was a lot of issues that were weaponized against them that they were trying to solve that prevented them from solving those issues. So this, I think, was, the 70s and the 60s was when polling started becoming big. And I think, as we have started seeing recently, polling, to some extent, is garbage. These people needed to be more deeply rooted into the communities which they were working in. But with the rise of this theocratic doctrine again, came with it the authoritarian capitalism that FDR and many others had been fighting against and had tamed. The book, So Much Damn Money also talks about that, or So Damn Much Money, but there's another book that I just, it's on the tip of my tongue and I can't think of it right now. But, you know, that authoritarian capitalism, which If you don't believe that you are destined to be up under its weight, you will fight against it. And that's where the theocracy or the theocratic tendency comes in. The sad part was, instead of understanding that the rot, which I, you know, there were some congressional people on in the Senate and stuff that understood this, but most did not. Instead of understanding that the rot that had existed in the South was now spreading throughout the land, many people, including those in the media, said, okay, we're going to coddle these people. We're going to give them the same respect that we give everybody else. They didn't realize the danger that was occurring. Now, look, to be fair, I think the reason why they didn't realize the danger that was occurring is because you got to understand how the society works, ladies and gentlemen. You see one person on TV when it comes to news back in the 70s, right? Walter Cronkite. What you didn't see was the people who were behind him, the people who were behind them, by the way, that would be the staff who was behind him, and the correspondents and things, and then the people who were behind them, which would have been your managers, your executives, and things like that, and then the people who were behind them were the owners. Now, at that time, the owners were less hands-on than they are now. But when you become as big as Walter Cronkite, you get to know people. You get to know a lot of people, including the owner. And in those associations that bound the owners together, these people were trying to suture and nurture and bring into alignment new friendships and new partnerships from down south. In other words, integration wasn't just for black people. Many, many, many southern business people who had been ostracized in the north because their practices not only embarrassed the north, but also went against the humanitarian principles from the north. They were able to start to join these groups. And so it is my belief that as these people were brought in and these associations were merged, there were decisions made, especially as their political whims and organizational principles started being implemented. There was a decision to be made to not, you know, to go a little easy on them because, hey, these are Americans too, particularly white Americans. And so it blinded people to the actual danger of what these people sought to accomplish. Now, what leads me to believe this is in books that I've read, but also in a very, very seldomly quoted Dr. King speech, which was delivered, I believe, in February of 1968, he mentions Ronald Reagan. And pegs the man very correctly. Dr. King was linked to a lot of very, very high-level people. I mean, when you get in with the Kennedys, then you get in with the Kennedy clan and their dozens and hundreds of clients and their connections, their networks, and things like that. Dr. King understood that there was this battle going on at the upper regions of the society between wealthy people. And all of them were putting their future stars out, trying to arrange the chessboard so they could get leverage on everybody else and take over. Reagan was one of those chess pieces. And he saw him as a danger, King did. Reagan, in 68, was a more competent and likable version of Goldwater, not his words, mine. Goldwater was the first attempt. That's, you know, it was funny. I've read John Dean's book, Conservatives Without Conscience, and it's funny to me, you know, how, yeah, I have great respect for John Dean, may I say, but it's kind of funny to me how everybody, including John Dean, wants to rehabilitate who Goldwater was. Goldwater was the first attempt at what Reagan was able to finally do. They polished Goldwater. They polished Nixon. And they made Reagan what both of them were not. Palatable. Reagan implemented that theocratic oligarchic Republican system, the first stages of it, significantly in the 1980s. And throughout the 90s, with the rise of conservative media and the like, the idea of secular Christianity, which I know, there's many of you like, wow, that just can't be. That doesn't, come on, man. That, seriously? Guys, get out of your head real quick and sit down and think on it. You'll see the power in it because it existed. There are certain structures in Christianity which, yes, the country did reproduce, but those structures were stripped of certain harsh aspects, and Enlightenment principles were put in its place. The problem has been the middle ground between the two. Whether or not you will re-implement those harsh measures and take out the humanitarian principles, or you'll keep the humanitarian principles and change Christianity altogether. So think about it. Throughout the 90s, though, with the rise of Christian radio, conservative radio, which started in the 80s, by the way, but it really started dominating in the 90s and the early 2000s, the idea of secular Christianity was whittled down significantly. And that then opened up the door for more of these theocratic Republicans to take positions in power. I mean, this is what has been happening. And where we are now is a position of mortal danger. We're in a position of mortal danger because the secular Christian forces, which if you look at a lot of communists, a lot of socialists from the 1920s, the 1930s, the 1910s, back into the 1800s, even anarchists, many of them accepted and practiced from the social gospel. They looked at the social, they looked at the Bible as interpretive of a social gospel that promised freedom through democratic exchange. A lot of those forces, starting in the 50s, were whittled down and exercised. It's like taking those portions from the human body that regulate the human body, that protect the human body, that make the human body strong within the blood. You know, there's these, you know, platelets and stuff that do all that. And it's like taking all that stuff out of the human body and trying to replace all of it with artificial replacements. It may work for a while, but the body's going to break down, and that's where we're at. The secular Christianity, which is desperately needed, the resurrection of the social gospel, which is such a threat to the theocratic Republicans that they attack it at every level. This is why they went hard after secular humanism. Because it is a threat. The theocratic Republican desires hierarchy, where the king is at, I'm sorry, where the priest is at the top. Even though they want to form a kingship, that's what it's all about. You don't form a theocracy unless you plan to have a kingship. They don't believe in democracy, because in a Republican society, you don't need democracy. Whereas the secular Christians did believe in democracy and believed in commonwealth. Both of those things are important. They're principles which we don't even talk about much anymore. People just say, oh, well, we're a democratic republic. But nobody talks about commonwealth. Because, see, you need commonwealth. And I know you can go back to, I think it was Plato who wrote about commonwealth, and he tied it to the republic and all that other stuff. But the commonwealth that he talked about is vastly different than the commonwealth which we have to see, which is attached to democracy. FDR redefined commonwealth. And in his last message to the Congress, he really redefined commonwealth with his second Bill of Rights. I had to do this. This was not even a question. I had to do this. You know, here's what's so funny about this family. I was about to eat, and I decided that I would record this because I figured I would, you know, like record 15 minutes now and then record 15 minutes after I eat. I didn't do that. I just went through and I recorded it because it was that important. I believe in democracy. I want to state that. I believe in democracy. As long as you have a republic, you will have an oligarchy. Because a republic thrives off of the body of the lower class. It draws energy and sustenance and money and resources from the people at the bottom and always deposits it at large amounts at the top. The goal with secular Christian concepts was to implement humane safeguards that would prevent the republic from turning into a oligarchic monarchy, you know? And so, unfortunately, we're kind of headed in a way that suggests that we're gonna have to fight, or else we're going to get there. We're going to turn into an oligarchic monarchy. An oligarchic Republican monarchy, may I say, because they'll still, you know, yell about the hierarchy and say that it's a republic and everything. And I suppose they'd be right for some time. But Mr. Schaefer is correct. People underestimated the danger of these people. They underestimated them. Questions, comments, concerns, reach out to me, y'all. It's so funny. I have stuff that I'm going to publish, but I have to keep putting it off because I got to get these things to you. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, please reach out to me, y'all. I'm your brother, Vimeo Deese. I'll talk to you. Peace. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again. How the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who find they can't take anymore.
and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone, and they're alive.